Greetings, everyone, and this is Brother Bedford, and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Black Millionaire Entrepreneurs, where it is our mission to bring you the brothers and sisters who've decided to take the plunge, who've took the risk, who got out and really decided to take their talents, their skills, and their gifts, and just, in most cases, just their passion and just a desire to change their realities. And they've built enterprises. That's the mission, and I think we've been doing a good job of bringing you those brothers and sisters who've been there and done that, and today is no exception. I mean, today's guest is someone that, this is my brother from another mother, so, I mean, we've been like kindred spirits since we've met, and we're going to talk about the philosophies and how we clicked and what we feel about entrepreneurship and the right path to build wealth, and we're going to get into all of those things. So I'm extremely excited because this conversation is long overdue. Devin Robinson, he's known to many as Professor Devin. He's a business and economics professor and an author of 8, I want you to count that, 8 self-help books. Now, Professor Devin is the founder of Urban Business Institute and the Beauty Supply Institute. These are organizations that train thousands of entrepreneurs annually to get into business and to focus on the beauty supply industry, specifically beauty supply store ownership. Now, he resigned from his corporate job in 2004 to begin building his own enterprises, and we're going to talk a lot about that. And then after achieving some success, that's when he began to help others to do the same. Now, to date, I believe, and he'll correct me if I'm wrong, but to date, I believe that my brother Devin is responsible for almost 500 businesses being open, and he's helped to start 25% of all the black beauty supply stores in America. Now, he has tons of media appearances to his credit. He is known to participate in activism for entrepreneurship, social and political issues. And if I try to list all of the accolades and every media outlet that my brother has been on, we wouldn't have enough time for this interview. So without further delay, I want to welcome to the call my brother, Professor Devin Robinson. How you doing today, dear brother?
Man, with such an introduction, I don't know if there's anything I can say. I think you done preceded everything.
Yeah,
I appreciate that introduction, man. Such an illustrious introduction. And, of course, you know, I'm glad to be on with you as always and given the opportunity to share with your audience some of the, you know, modest successes that I've had myself.
Oh, man. Well, look, the honor is really all mine, man. You and I have talked about this thing. We've been working together, doing some things, and this is long overdue just to have a conversation so that I can share with those who listen and follow me what I see in you and the brilliance and the things that you bring to the table. So, man, I'm truly honored that you would give me a few moments of your time to share some things. Now, I've read, you know, I just shared a little bit about you, but look, nobody can really tell us the story of how this thing has really come to fruition for you like yourself. So would you tell the listening audience who is Professor Devin Robinson?
Well, you know, I grew up in a modest household, two-parent household, working parents, working-class, middle-class family. All my siblings are, you know, working-class, middle-class parents and, you know, homemakers themselves. And that's really the path that I was going on. I always had a type of rebellious nature. But, you know, like many of the youth today, a rebellious nature with no vision or no structure or no guidance can, you know, lead you off the beaten path.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of, you know, that happened for me a few times. I stumbled, you know, bruised my kneecaps until I started to drill down and settle down into, you know, a bigger purpose or a sense of purpose in my life. And my you know, my mistakes and stuff that I made in life, they were recoverable. That's the thing, you know. For a lot of the youth today, they often make mistakes that are just irreversible. You know what I'm saying? So I thank God I was blessed to be able to recover from those types of things. But as I found my sense of purpose, I just started digging deeper into, like, a greater sense of self, you know, that I could be doing way more than just punching this corporate clock. And you know, and I tell people there's not even anything wrong with punching a corporate clock because, you know, there are far fewer businesses than there are employees and people to build them. So you need people to build and be part of a vision. I mean, you know, even Martin Luther King wouldn't be who he was if you didn't have a team. You know, you got to have a team of people around you to help till the soil with you. But the problem becomes, and what I tell people when it comes to entrepreneurship and business, the problem becomes when you do have the capacity or the potential or the desire to do more, and instead you settle for less. That's when it becomes a problem. So if you have a sense of the person that's carving the road and creating their own path in life, and often those people, to be quite honest, a lot of founders of businesses are horrible at actually running the business. You know what I'm saying? So they can go out with the vision and kind of, you know, break ground. But once it's once ground is broken, they need a team to help put the walls up. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Get the beams of the building going, and then they need people to come in to maintain the building. And a lot of times they're just not good at that. You know what I'm saying? So everyone has their piece in the puzzle. And that's what I was finding myself, that, you know, I'm a person that has a creative spirit, the guts to go out and go against the odds, or, you know, be the underdog with no intimidation and no fear. And I just decided to resign from a corporate job. And I was in a company that was in turmoil, and it was around the time when jobs were scarce and people were trying to hold on to jobs, man. You know, it was the early 2000s and or getting into the mid-2000s, you know, and I just felt that there was just more that I needed to be doing. So I just resigned with no clear plan in place of what I was going to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that. And once I did that, you know, I really, you know, the thing is, being in business is a lot more fearful than it is once you get in and get used to the new conditioning, because that's really all it is. It's just new conditioning. You're used to having things laid out for you when you're, you know, working for someone else, and you don't know if you have what it takes to be the one that creates that infrastructure that you can lean on. And that, I think, was the biggest learning curve for me. You know, trying to seek out everything to keep my life sustainable, such as health insurance and my schedule and when should I do certain things and how much should I price my products for. It was just so much. It's kind of overwhelming when you think about it,
mm-hmm.
unless you have the guidance to do that. You know, some people talk about, you know, getting a mentor, but a mentor is still not even enough,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, mentors are often, you know, doing their own thing and they can give you a little guidance here and there. But you need to be part of something that you can really be a bloodsucker of. You know what I'm saying?
I like this.
You got to be able to, like, leech off as much as you can. And you can't really do that to a mentor. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, something that you can burn a mentor out. And you can't burn out someone you're paying. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You're paying a consultant. You're paying a trainer. There's no such thing as burning them out, because you're paying for that. So I strongly believe in that. But that's really how my life, you know, the direction it went in and how it kind of morphed. And the more time I spent in entrepreneurship full time, the better I became. And I didn't ever have to look back. You know, thank God, you know, knock on wood, I didn't have to look back. And I've been growing ever since, you know, to the point where I got a few dozen employees on payroll, and we're running major enterprises out here, and that's really what it is. And I've taken my success, and I'm trying to help other people do the same.
Man, you know, now it's interesting because you know, when you mentioned the time period, I had to think back, and you're right, 2004. I mean, that was a period, you know, where the country was shedding like hundreds of thousands of jobs per month. This was a very serious time. And so here it is. The economy is very shaky. I know that this was obviously 3 years after 9/11, and so a whole bunch of different things were happening. The real estate boom was getting ready to come to a close right around that time.
Oh,
and
yeah.
As you mentioned, these big companies were going under, the banks and all of these different things, and they were shedding 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 jobs per month. What gave you the internal strength, or did you even know that you were going to start your own thing? I know you said you resigned, but did you have in mind to say, well, I'm getting ready to build a business?
Yeah, well, let me tell you exactly what happened, bring it down to details, because I know a lot of listeners, they feel like when people are being interviewed, they're skipping over stuff, or when they're training, they're skipping over stuff. So I'll drill
right.
down
right.
to as much details as I can and not shotgun and make this thing pretty.
Okay.
What really was happening is I was working for a technology company that was it was the largest accounting scandal ever in history, $9 billion in accounting scheme. The CEO is still serving time in prison. I think they gave him like 40 years or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The company I was working for is responsible for the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, where CEOs are now responsible for the SEC filings, the 10-K
mm-hmm.
reports, the public filings of their company. You know, usually before, the CFO could file it, and the CEO was not held responsible. And because of him and the arguments of, yes, he knew, and he said, no, I didn't. I didn't know that was fraud. And he said, yes, you did. They created that whole act. You know, the senator and representative, Sarbanes and Oxley, came together, wrote that, and that's now a law. I was working for the company that made that happen. And it was, you're talking about consolidations like crazy. So airlines were consolidating. Retail companies were consolidating from the Office Depots to the Office Maxes to the Staples. All these companies were coming together, from Sirius X and XM. They were two separate companies coming together.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about massive consolidation. You're talking about buyouts, hostile takeovers. You're talking about the dot-com bubble had busted. You're talking about we're now at war in the Middle East, you know, falsified war. You're talking about the housing bubble, you know, the whole mortgage predatory lending thing was coming to a crash, and the banking was coming to a halt. Yeah, all of that was happening in the mid-2000s.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working – what happened with me, the company I was working for is called WorldCom. They were the largest Internet provider in the world. They owned 70% of all Internet across the world. Everyone else was either leasing from them or dwarfed by them. So when I was working for them and all of that took place, it happened 2 years prior, 2002, and people started losing their jobs at the company, and I was watching people's lives get destroyed. And I started getting nervous, like, wait a minute, I got a wife and kids. How do I manage? Like, what happens? And I started really, really, I mean, Brother Bedford, when I tell you I was really, really meditating, I was really meditating. Like, I was not daydreaming in the car. I was
right.
in the dark in the closet meditating. Like,
right,
I was thinking,
serious
like,
prayer.
Okay. Yeah, like, wait a minute. If I was to lose my job today, how
right.
far could I go without income? That was the main question I was asking myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I was not diversified properly. I had no other income. My job was my main income. You know how that is. My salary is $80,000, $85,000 a year, and everything's great. And I'm a young guy in my 20s, late 20s. I'm just having a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I got to start prepping myself. And I went into a self-induced sacrificial mode. Nothing happened to me, and I wasn't laid off, but I just started preparing for it. I said, you know what? I got to set myself up. So I downsized like crazy. People were thinking – I had people thinking I joined a cult because I got rid of my – from designer clothes. I had a Benz and a BMW. They were gone. I'm now driving a Nissan and a Caravan. You know
wow.
what I'm saying?
Right.
And people were like, what is wrong with this guy? And I'm like, I'm preparing, man. I'm a doomsday prepper. And I just said, you know, even, you know, my then wife, she's my ex-wife now, but she – was like, what is wrong? What are we doing? And I'm like, we're downsizing everything. We can't eat out. We can't do anything. And my mission was to reduce my expenses as much as possible and start to create new income. So as I was reducing my expenses, I started, like, leveraging my credit and the little bit of money that I had. I started getting into real estate, and I started flipping houses, and I started getting rental properties, and I started getting rental income. And I'm looking at my income saying, okay, all I need is about 6 properties to as rental properties to replace all my income. And, well,
right.
well, not all my income, but to cover all of my expenses because I had reduced
right.
my expenses so much. So I said if I get about 5 or 6 properties, all my bills are paid. And now I wouldn't be dependent on a job, but my tenants will be. They're going to go to work, and they're going to pay me to stay in my house so I can just chill. And Brother Bedford, the plan worked pretty much without a hitch. Mm. And that's how I staged my walkout. Now, what happened, what ultimately happened that caused me to actually resign, one day, the company kept making changes. Like, we got to do this, we got to do that. You know, like most companies, now you got to take on a new duty, a new task, a new project. And one day in 2004, they said, hey, we're going to now, your department, which I was an engineer, we did the optical networks and the ATM frame relays, routers, that kind of stuff. And the management came down and said, hey, from now, our department has now been charged to do inside wiring. Now, for people that don't know what inside wiring is pretty much the telephone man coming to your house. And they're dealing with that single phone line that's at your house.
Right.
So here I am working on equipment that carries 20,000 phone lines, 20,000 packets and circuits, and I'm dealing with major traffic, and I'm getting paid high to do that. And now they're saying, well, we're going to get rid of our pretty much our linemen, and you guys got to now get in a truck and go out to the houses and do that as well as maintain inside.
Wow.
And let me tell you what first came to my mind, Brother Bedford. Shame. I said to myself, because the inside wiring was, we had to go out and troubleshoot phone lines in people's houses that had a problem. So they would call in, open a trouble ticket, something's wrong with that line, and, you know, like that warranty type of thing you have on your phone, I mean on your phone lines, you got to go out and troubleshoot it. We had to do that. And when they brought it to us, it was a suspicion at first that, hey, I think we're going to have to do that. It was like whispers. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. And one day, it came down and it said, yep, our department has been charged, and you guys are now going to have to do inside wiring. And I said, to hell I am. Now, why I said shame was because I was like, what if one of my tenants call me? You know what I'm saying? And I'm out there, like, in the mud, in the rain, in the crawl space. Like, I'm troubleshooting my houses, my tenants' phone line.
No, that's
like, my pride was the thing that kicked in.
Right.
And I said, you know what? I'm earning enough money for my rent. I can cover my expenses. I'm good. I'm out of here. And with that, Brother Bedford, I resigned. That's how I was out of here. And they looked at me as if I was crazy. They were like, you cannot resign. You're one of the senior men in the building. You're getting a good income. Like, you're going to ride this out. What's out there? The economy's bad. Blah, blah. I said, nah, I'm good. I had a few bucks from flipping houses. So I had some good money in my pocket, and I had the cash flow coming in, and I left. And that is when I went home, sat on my hands, and started to craft my plan, my strategy, to really get into, like, businesses. But I didn't know. I had no idea what I wanted to do.
Now, and that was getting ready. That was getting ready to be my next question, because you seem like you got into real estate now, and you didn't have any formal training. You weren't taking any courses or anything. You just
said, not at all.
I'm getting ready to do this.
Not at all. Like, the only experience I had was when I was 19 years old was when I bought my first property.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought a house. I was in the military then. And I bought a house, and within 6 months later, I came down on orders to go overseas, and I was forced to rent it. And I immediately became a landlord. And I had a property management company, Coldwell Banker, some one of those real estate companies.
Mm-hmm.
And a Coldwell Realty, something like that. And they were renting my house, and I just saw the deposits going into my bank account every month while I was overseas. And I said, huh, this is interesting. I'm a landlord? Is that what's happening here? you know what I'm saying?
Right.
And I was 19, but I never really explored it that much until, you know, then, you know, fast forward 10 years later, I'm dealing with, you know, this situation. And I'm like, well, I think real estate can do it. I have no real estate license. I have no mortgage training. I'm just out there with a broker, my agent, finding houses. And I'm like looking at it like, yeah, I guess it's good. I guess I'll buy it. And I'm buying them. And I'm buying houses that, like, my gut, like, I didn't ever lose in a house. I didn't ever lose. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I always made money on every house, and I was not a trained investor. I didn't have a license. I wasn't even a home inspector. Like, I had to hire a home inspector, and that guy loved me. He was inspecting houses like crazy for me.
Right.
And that really was it. I just created that income for myself. And you know, just kind of piggybacking on that point too, it helped me really realize that people who are out here working are in more fear than they should be. Because if you're working and you don't want to be, you're not part of a team that you enjoy building and you want to be part of something else, you know, it's not that hard to set up your own retirement plan. Like, I went out and I look at stuff like some of these apartment buildings, not even a real huge building, like a 12-unit building. Mm-hmm. And something like that, you're talking about walking away with maybe $4,000, $5,000 a month in profit.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of, like, that could be your retirement plan for the rest of your life. Like, you can set up income for yourself.
Absolutely.
And it's not that difficult. You just have to be disciplined and have self-control in order to be an entrepreneur. And that's probably the biggest thing that people fail at, having that self-control.
Yeah. You know, I want to talk about that, too, in a few moments. But I want to go back to this part. So now you're doing the real estate. And now you said you sat down after you resigned, and you said, now I'm going to go into serious business. So what was your first business venture after the real estate?
So I was in real estate, and then I started trading stocks. So I got in, I think I saw something on TV or something, you know, about stocks, and I got into day trading. Again, no formal license. I got a mentor, went through a class, and started day trading. And I learned a whole lot about stocks and making money, taught me how to, you know, make $300 at least a day off of every stock. So I'm kind of playing around with that. And then I had a friend we went to the gym together, and she was a mortgage broker, and she wanted to start her own mortgage company. Mm-hmm. And came to me and, you know, asked me to be an investor. I did it, and that was kind of like my first little run at having a formal business, being an owner of a mortgage lending company. But I still wasn't the owner-operator. I was just the owner. She was the one running the day-to-day everything. I didn't know anything about what she was doing. And then after that, what happened was I had a friend that came to me now for another investment, because, you know, people now see me, you know, transition from being an employee. They're trying to, like, hey, you know something. Yeah. And I'm still trying to figure things out myself. But he came to me and said, you know, he feels like he's trapped in his job as a barber, and he's paying all his boot rent, and he'd love to have his own barbershop. Can I be an investor? And I said, I sat with him at lunch. I know him, and I think I knew him a little too well that I decided to say, nah, I'm not going to give you the money. How about I open the barbershop, and you become my manager, and I'm not going to charge you boot rent. So you can do whatever you want with your money. Just manage the shop and make sure people pay me my boot rent. And
right.
He went for it. He went for it. So I'm like, wow, okay, so I did that. And that was like, okay, I'm getting closer now to running a brick-and-mortar operation. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
okay, I'm getting closer and closer, because now I'm going in, they know me, they're giving me my boot rent, he's running it. And then I'm like, okay, I'm entrepreneur, and I got my real estate, I got the mortgage, the shop, I'm diversifying. Like, my family, you know, I didn't have to sleep on the couch anymore. My wife said, oh, yeah, you can come to bed.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? You come to the bedroom, and I'm like, okay. And then I was out shopping for the barbershop. It was a barbershop salon. It was unisex. And then I got threatened in a beauty supply store by a Korean with a golf club, thinking I'm browsing too much, too long. And he was like, hurry up and buy. Thought I was going to steal. And he was like, just get out of here with the golf club. And I was like, okay, he got me in a good day. And I left. But I started thinking to myself, this guy's treating me like this. That's not right. How is he probably treating everyone else? And I'm a business person at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And I left, but it stuck in my mind. And I'm like, you know what? Maybe I should just open a beauty supply store. How about that? And with that knee-jerk reaction, I went ahead and opened a beauty supply store, not knowing anything. Again, you talk about my formal training? None. I'm
right.
not a cosmetologist, a barber. I don't know anything about the products. I'm just a guy that I think was pretty good at business. And all my degrees are in business. That's okay to have, but it doesn't take you where you need to go as far as entrepreneurship.
Right.
So I'm now opening a beauty supply store right next door to my salon. And when I got in, that's when everything opened up for me, and I realized that how that Korean treated me is actually a hysteria across our country. It's a phenomenon. Like, it's not just me. It's industry-wide. Mm-hmm. So when I got in, I was stuck. I couldn't find products. I couldn't get anything done. I had already signed the lease because I thought once you got the money, everything's fair, you're going to get through. No, not true.
Right.
And I'm just now struggling trying to get my store up and running. But guess what happened? Remember 10 years before I told you I had a property? I was 19, and I wound up I was in the military, and they sent me overseas, and I had to rent that property out.
Right.
Well, guess what? They sent me to Korea.
Right.
So I was in Korea 10 years before.
Right.
Hating Korea, hating the whole culture, the language, the smell of the country, everything. But now I had just stumbled upon an industry where it's dominated by Koreans.
Dominated by them, correct.
So I leveraged everything that happened to me 10 years before. I said, aha, mm-hmm. I'm going to talk to these guys as if I'm their friends.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of me being mean, which was my approach first because I couldn't understand why they were being so mean towards me as far as helping me get into the business, I said, let me switch it up. And I went in and I started talking about the little Korean that I know, the foods. I'm telling them their country is great. They're asking me where I went. I'm telling the cities I've been to, the beaches, everything. And they started smiling and loving me.
Right.
And from then, I started to really break through and get in to the business properly. And
right.
That's when I started to build my stores. That's when I started to, like, make progress. And ever since, I figured out how the business works, and I forged good relationships with them, and ever since, my business has been taking off. And that's
wow.
really my journey. So I kind of went into the details of how I went from just working on a job and all the things that happened that led to me setting myself up, getting the money, planning to leave the job, getting into business, having the discipline to manage my money properly as an entrepreneur, investing in the right things, starting brick and mortars, getting out there to now owning schools that teach people how to do the same thing.
Yeah, man, and thank you for taking us through that journey, because I think that takes us right to this next question I want to ask you, because now at this moment, now that you've started with the beauty supply stores and you're doing the business, is that when the first book came or the idea to, because it was Taking It Back, you know, you decided you're making these relationships with the Koreans and you're doing business, but at the same time you're going into competition with them. So how did that first movement or that book, how did that come about at this particular time?
The book came about with it came about when people kept asking me to help them to own a beauty supply store. So they keep coming to my store, and they're like, a black guy behind the counter, what are you doing? I mean, some people come in and like, you got the Koreans tied up in the back. Are you robbing this place? I'm
right.
Like, nah, I'm the owner. And I just didn't know how significant it was for a black person to own a store. So
right.
As they kept asking me, I said, well, let me just write a book, and maybe that can help people. And I wrote the book. It went crazy. I'm now in Ebony Magazine doing interviews like crazy. I'm on Fox, the Michael Bazin show, CBS. I'm like everywhere doing interviews over this book that I wrote about helping black people own beauty supply stores.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, I thought, okay, I'm the author, best-selling. Okay, I'm done. It's good. And it didn't stop there. People kept asking for more as they read my books. Well, can you give us some training? Can you have classes? And it just slowly evolved from there. And the book was out maybe about two, three years before I decided to actually start the institute that trained people on how to be successful in the business.
Wow. I mean, that's a nugget right there. I mean, first you took your knowledge, you put it in a book, the book began to sell. You begin to get publicity, speaking on national television and radio, and then that led to you opening up the institute to teach more people about how to get in the beauty supply industry. And now that institute has conferences, what, every year, twice a year? How does that work now with the institute?
Yeah, the conferences are twice a year, summer and winter. And then we have a summit now, mid-year conference that we do, that just kind of give people an introduction to the business as well.
Wow. So now, yeah, I mean, this is amazing, man, because how many stores have you opened up to date?
94.
Helped open up?
94 stores.
Wow. That's phenomenal. And how many Black Beauty Supply stores are in the United States?
About 400, 350 to 400.
Wow. Yes, yeah, so yep. About 25% of the market. Wow. I mean, that's just a
yep.
phenomenal feat, man. And that's, you know, when you and I first met, you know, that was intriguing. Of course, I'd heard you on the Michael Bazin show, but then you and I end up meeting at the Power Networking Conference through a mutual friend of ours, Andrew Morrison.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was just phenomenal that you had been doing that type of work. I mean, let's fast forward. I mean, I could talk about that all day, but then now, because you dropped some seeds earlier, because now you have this love for brick-and-mortar businesses. I know your
yes.
language, deeds and keys.
That's right.
So now you went into your book, Power Move. You wrote 8 books, but I don't know which order they came, but I know now you got Power Move, and now you got opened up another institute around 2012, 2013. So how did you go from the Beauty Supply Institute to the Urban Business Institute?
Well, I wrote the book because, okay, so I was helping people open stores and people helping them learn about the beauty supply business. But what was happening was I was going out to some of these clients and helping them, you know, be successful. And what I was finding was a lot of them did not know the arts of entrepreneurship. Like, they didn't know how to be entrepreneurs, but they came into some money. So they were drilling down their 401ks, they were insurance settlements, they had savings, and they were deciding to open these businesses, but they really didn't have the skill set for entrepreneurship, like the mindset, how that works, the whole nine. And when I started to see that, like, they would be asking me questions, and I'm telling them, no, that's not how it's done, you do X, Y, Z. And I'm like, wait a minute, this is a big gap. So they're jumping into a business without real sound entrepreneurial knowledge. And that's when I said, no, I need to show people how to become successful in entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
Forget just beauty supply stores. How do they become successful in entrepreneurship? That's where that whole movement of Urban Business Institute came from. So I wrote that book, and then the same thing happened. People wanted more. They wanted classes. And then I said, you know what, I'm going to create an institute just like Beauty Supply Institute, but just for entrepreneurship, to teach people how to understand the art of entrepreneurship that they can take to any industry that they choose. Rather than just speaking specifically about beauty supply, I can use some of those talents that I use to transition from employee to employer, and that's how that came about.
Wow. And that book was Power Move, right?
Yes, Power Move.
Yeah, and that book details everything that you went over, your story and how you transitioned from being an employee to an employer. It's a must-have. Now, how can they get that book?
They can go to mypowermove.com. Mypowermove.com is where they can get that book from. And I will say, I mean, a lot of people have read it. They say every college student needs to have it. Every entrepreneur needs to have it. It is straight up just the best book on business that I've ever written, and I would put it up against any business book out there. Like,
yeah.
It rivals any business book out there, and many people would have that same sentiment.
Yeah, and no, I can definitely I concur with that. I've read the book several times. Actually, a copy is right here on my desk as we speak. And so, yeah, I concur with that. And I guess the thing that's most intriguing about the book is that it is not a book of, you know, these airy philosophies of, you know, entrepreneurship and business, just positive thinking. I mean, you really get into the nuts and bolts and what it really takes to build a business. I mean, how did you because I think that's where we really click, because both of us have been on the circuit. We're talking, even when I'm doing my internet piece, there's, you know, this, I can just, you know, get online and my computer is going to spit out money. And I'm like, no. It doesn't work like that. And so you and I kind of click that there's this real mindset and personal mastery that you have to really get engaged in if you're going to be an entrepreneur. So how did you really embrace that concept or that philosophy and then put that in the book and now let that be your guide? I mean, what was the impetus for that?
You know, I'm a person that I only speak what I know. Mm-hmm. And the thing that makes me, you know, they tell me that in the industry and why I'm such a threat to non-black beauty supply store owners, they said that I'm a perfect storm, right? So I've taught college. I was an author before I got into the business. I was an author before I got into business, period. And I'm actually a business owner, a true, in a sense, business owner with commercial locations and commercial length leases, 5-10-year leases, that kind of stuff. So when you ask someone to put a school together or put training together, you want them to come with sound experience. So not only do I write books, so the textbooks that people have in my academies are the ones that I've written. Mm-hmm. The curriculum that they got, I wrote them because I learned how to do lesson plans and curriculum at the college level, teaching business and economics, some courses I created. And then I'm bringing knowledge from the real world of business. I know the challenge of I only have enough money to pay rent, taxes, or payroll. Which one do I pay? You know what I'm saying? Right. The textbooks are just telling you as if everything's glory. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, oh, the money's going to be there. You just put the plan together, and people are going to come in, and they're going to buy, and you give great customer service. And it's not true. You're going to have difficult customers. You're going to have people that are going to try to steal from you as employees. Like, you're not going to come out here, start a business, and put out applications, people apply, you hire them, and then they behave themselves because right. You're paying them. That's not true. Like, people are going to try to steal from you. They're going to try to get over on you. They're going to not be reliable. How do you deal with that as an entrepreneur? So how do you set up your business where if people let you down, the customers don't feel it or the customers can't see it? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Like, you have to know that kind of stuff. A textbook is not telling you that. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And you really have to find that place before you can get out there and teach other people how to do it. So for me, I think that's what was happening. I was actually walking that journey, right? I was actually walking that out. Mm-hmm. So when it was time to really, you know, get in there and show other people how to do it, it almost came second nature. I remember I'm three classes short of a doctorate degree, and I quit college. I was supposed to graduate my doctorate in 2011, and I quit, and I've been protesting ever since in my brain. I'm not protesting anyone. I'm protesting in my brain, right? Because when I was working on my doctorate, I kept getting these professors that were teaching theory, right? And I would be asking them very challenging questions, and it became a point where they stopped warning me in their class. And every time I come to their class, they were like, oh, my God, Devin Robinson's in here. Like, it was a problem. Right. And I'm like, no, I need to be challenged, because at this point, I'm owning businesses by this point, right? So I guess I'm their worst nightmare, because they're teaching in the college classroom. I mean, I have professors telling me, you know, once you get your PhD, man, you're going to be like the consultant to the CEO of the company. You're going to have their ear. And I'm sitting there like, ho, I got my hands in the air like, excuse me. And they're like, hey, what do you need? I'm like, help me figure something out. A PhD is a terminal degree, like the highest I can go, right? They're like, yeah. So if this is the highest I can go, why am I still only the consultant to the CEO? What degree does the CEO have?
Great question.
Get me that degree. You know what I'm saying? Because if you're not training me how to be a CEO, what are you training me to become? A CEO? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, nah, this is a problem. You guys are ripping people off. And I'm trying to talk to people in my the class, like my coworkers, and I mean, like my classmates. And they're like, oh, because a lot of them were working in corporate America. Mm-hmm. And they were drinking the juice. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, nah, man, I can't do this. I'm out of here. And with that, I quit. And I haven't been back ever since. And people are telling me I'm crazy. Man, just finish the classes. I'm like, yeah, but in order to finish, I got to give them more tuition. And I can't give them more money when they don't know as much about breaking ground in business than I do.
Right.
I don't, just for the title, that's not right.
Right.
These professors are teaching in theory. They're not teaching from practical. Mm. I can't give them any more money. And that became a battle of the mind for me. And I haven't been able to go back ever since. Wow. So that's kind of, you know, where I come from and how my approach has been with business and training.
Man, this is great, man. So let me ask you this as we get ready to wind down. I got about 100 questions I want to ask you, but we'd have to save that for another time. But if you were to advise someone who is interested in becoming an entrepreneur, who's just starting, what would be the first steps? I mean, since you've taken your journey now, and now you can look back, and obviously you've written the book, someone is asking, you know, Professor Devin, I want to get into entrepreneurship. What should be my first step? What would be that advice to them?
Let me tell you something. If I could go back and do it all over again, because I missed one crucial step, and this is this is just real, real, real talk. You know what I'm saying? Keeping it real with the listeners. I would straight up go after training. Like, I would go after not college. I would go after entrepreneurial training. Like, if there's someone that you know, or there's a program or something that's out there, and I'm not talking going to the SBA or the SCORE, you know, not these kind of, I don't want to say popsicle, but these type of one-size-fits-all things. Like, you have to go to, like, black entrepreneurs, we got to go to stuff that's specific to black entrepreneurs. Like, you got to find training opportunities that are speaking to the black entrepreneur, because there are a lot of challenges. Like, you know, I talk to people all the time that, you know, racism doesn't die because you start doing business. And a lot of people confuse that. You know what I'm saying? Racist people use racism based on the weapons at their disposal. So a restaurant, a server is going to do whatever with your food or your service or whatever. A teacher who's racist will misguide you and probably try to suppress your mind or throw you in some type of slow pro class or diagnose you with ADHD, you know, ADHD, that kind of stuff.
Right.
Police officers, they wage racism with their guns, their beatings, their authority, false imprisonment, false arrests. Mm. Sometimes it leads to death. So it's based on the level of power that you have is how far you can carry out your racism. It doesn't die simply because now you're doing business and people start to play fear. That's not how it works. So I say that to say that as an entrepreneur, you're going to continue to face racism. You're going to go to the banks, and if someone's in there racist, they're going to push your stuff to the side or delay you. You go to get a commercial property or a lease or finance a property or buy a house. If the person's racist, they're going to treat you poorly. Mm-hmm. If you need products, inventory, or distribution, same thing. They're going to treat you poorly. It just depends on their level of authority and power, right? Mm-hmm. So what that means is us as black people, we have to get a specific type of training. While we're learning entrepreneurship, we got to learn how to navigate these challenges and get past certain things while we're trying to do business. No different than training a black person how to interact with the police. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Mm-hmm. White people don't need that kind of training.
Right.
It's you know, they dominate, so they don't need, you know, police engagement training per se. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I saw in the news last night that a 16-year-old girl killed an Uber driver at 3 o'clock in the morning in Chicago. I don't know if you heard about that, but
not yet.
She was out, and she went into Walmart and bought, like, a machete and a knife, called the Uber driver. He picked her up, and she hacked him to death in the car. And the police came because he ran and he died on someone's front step. They called the police. They found her behind the building. and she still had the weapon. She's bloody or whatever. And they said they tased her to get her to drop the weapons and arrested her. I was like, ain't that some, you know what? I'm like, cause you know, on site, a black person would have been shot.
Absolutely.
You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
But we can't get angry because this is the world that they worked hard to create and stay in power for hundreds of years. What we now have to do is recognize that this power exists, recognize that we need to be bold and not think that everything is fair and lovely simply because we got through our day without being called an N-word.
Mm-hmm.
We shouldn't feel like, oh, okay, I think we're post-racial society, and then something happens. And then we're like, oh, we're not. And then it calms down, and then we're like, oh, okay, now we are, and we're back to normal. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
That's a cycle that we create for ourselves. So because that's a reality for black folks, Brother Bedford, we need a special type of training. And
mm-hmm.
I try to tell people, you're not going to get the textbook regular, do a business plan and go to the bank and you're going to get funding. No. You're going to get, listen, this is how you do your business plan. This is how you speak to the banker. This is how you craft the numbers and try to explain to them a little better why your business plan is going to work. This is how you shed some of our culture and be a chameleon in order for them to not feel too threatened that you're going to be in business and be empowered. These are the things that we explain in training so that our entrepreneurs can go out and be much more successful than just getting generic training.
Right. Wow. Man, that's powerful, man. You said a mouthful. So look, with that said, tell us, where can they go and get this training? Talk to us about the Institute. How can they get involved with the Urban Business Institute?
Well, they can go to urbanbusinessinstitute.com, urbanbusinessinstitute.com. We have you get my books and stuff there. You can also get enrolled in training. We actually have an agreement now where we partnered with an agency recently that now is able, we're able to provide funding to our graduates for their business between $50,000 and $3 million, depending on their idea, their business, you know, the whole nine.
Wow.
So graduates of our program can now get that as well. So that's something that people should keep as a major incentive in getting trained. But Urban Business Institute.com is our website that you can go to learn about that.
And what about it now specific to the beauty supply industry? Where do they go to get information about the Beauty Supply Institute?
BeautySupplyInstitute.com, BeautySupplyInstitute.com. You go there, it takes you everywhere, from our conferences to our products to our online training to our live training to our summits to our consulting, everything that you need in all things beauty supply. We're the number one in the industry doing this, and you know, you can't go anywhere better to get the help that we provide. BeautySupplyInstitute.com.
Yeah, and they can get more information about just you. They can go to Devin Robinson. Is it Professor Devin Robinson or just DevinRobinson.com?
DevinRobinson.com. Just DevinRobinson.com. You go there and you get everything you need to know about me. It's kind of almost too much information out there, but Devin Robinson, D-E-V-I-N. Robinson.com.
Man. Well, brother, you know, I could talk to you forever, man, and I'm sure our listeners would love to hear more, so we definitely got to do a part two at a later date. But, man, I can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing your insights and your wisdom and your experience with us. Any parting words that you'd like to share with the listening audience, a nugget or a quote or anything that you'd like to leave us with before we sign off?
I mean, at the end of the day, if you're not doing what you love, you're doing what you accept. So if you know that you can go further and higher, you really want to take that approach and get out there and do it rather than just sitting around waiting for life to hand you whatever it decides to spit out.
Wow. So there you have it. You've heard it from my brother from another mother, Professor Devin Robinson. Again, you can get more information on him at DevinRobinson.com, www.DevinRobinson.com. If you have an interest in the beauty supply industry, opening up your own beauty supply store, you can go to the BeautySupplyInstitute.com. That's www.BeautySupplyInstitute.com. And in this world, this interesting world of entrepreneurship to really learn the real deal about entrepreneurship and what it really takes to be successful, you need to head on over to the UrbanBusinessInstitute.com. Once again, beloved, thank you so much, man, for sharing your time with me, man. I look forward to seeing you real soon. I'll be coming to one of your conferences real soon, so you all better hurry up and get over there and sign up so you can come and see me and Professor Devin at some of the conferences that he's hosting. So I look forward to seeing you real soon, dear brother.
Yeah, I appreciate having you you having me on the show. HowToConference.net is our next conference. It's part of our Urban Business Institute archives with one of the things that we do, teaching you multiple industries, one registration, multiple industries. That's HowToConference.com. Go there. You can register. Our next conference is in a few weeks in Atlanta, Georgia. Hopefully we can see you there. Learning about different industries that you might want to get into, and getting up close and personal with many of the presenters that, you know, in the ranks, we got some wealthy people in the front of these classrooms that I know personally. So it's something that you definitely want to take advantage of. That's the HowToConference.net.
Yeah, HowToConference.net. Yeah, and you're not bringing in any lightweights. I mean, George Frazier is going to be at this one, Dr. Dennis Kimbrough. I don't want to just start naming names. A whole bunch. Andrew Morrison, as we both talked about. So Dr. Stacy, N.C. Grant. I mean, so there's a lot of people, a lot of different industries. So you definitely want to try to make it there to this conference coming up. That's HowToConference.net. To register and come on down to Atlanta. And if you're in the Atlanta area, you have no excuse. It's a one-day conference. And so go to HowToConference.net to get all of that information. Once again, Professor Devin, it's been a pleasure. So thank you so much, dear brother, for being with us today.
Man, thanks for having me on.
Okay, so there you have it. We look forward to seeing you all again on another interesting and insightful episode of Conversations with Black Millionaire Entrepreneurs. So until then, take care, everybody.
Thank you for listening to my Conversations with Black Millionaire Entrepreneurs. And if you want more tips, more strategies, more notifications that would really take you into the mindset of these brilliant Black Millionaire Entrepreneurs, I need you to take out your phone and text my brother, that's the keyword, my brother, to 58885. Just text the keyword, my brother, to 58885. Or if you prefer, you can go online and just go to blackmillionairemindset.com. And once you enter your name and your email, I will immediately send you my video training, 10 Keys to Unlock Your Own Millionaire Mindset. So again, you can go to blackmillionairemindset.com, enter your name and email, and I'll send you the video training, or you can text the keyword, my brother, to 58885, and I'll make sure that you get the video training. This is your brother Bedford, and I look forward to seeing you and hearing from you in the next Conversations with Black Millionaire Entrepreneurs. Take care.